content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. I'll begin today with a story from the fiction section of the August 25th, 2025 issue of the New Yorker magazine. Something Has Come to Light by Miriam Toews. I trust I'll be in heaven when you read this, although God, in His wisdom, may have other things in store for me. Just yesterday afternoon, Cor asked me if I had ever thought I'd live this long, and I said no, not in a million years. What on earth am I doing here? It isn't necessary for all of your parents to read this, especially not Sandra. But Sandra, if you are reading this, please don't be angry with me. I love you very much. I think you know that. I just wanted to tell you grandkids, in confidence, that all those school photos of you, of all of you, from all the years, all 13 years, from kindergarten to grade 12, my goodness, there are so many, are in a thick blue photo album in the top drawer of my bedside table. There is a Bible verse on the cover of the album, one from Psalms. I will lift up mine eyes unto the hills, from whence cometh my help. My help cometh from the Lord, which made heaven and earth. You remember how Sandra hung those school photos up on thin silver cords in my living room with little clothespins? She said that it was the fashion to do that, and that this way I'll be able to see the photos all the time, hung out to dry in plain view. There they'd be as I walked through the living room to the kitchen, or to my bedroom, or to the porch. I could look at them all day, every day. Sandra also said that, with the photos attached to the cords with clothespins, I wouldn't pull the paint off the walls if I needed to move them. She has had to repaint many of my walls for that very reason, and it was incredibly difficult to find exactly the right shade of white paint to match what was already there. You have no idea how many shades of white paint there are these days. Bless her heart, but I just didn't enjoy seeing all your faces from all the years hanging from a wash line and staring out at me every day. I was afraid I'd begin not to see them, because they were always there. I didn't want to have fleeting glimpses of your faces as I passed them, back and forth from room to room, and I wasn't able to stand for long enough to look at them all before I'd get tired and need to sit. And I couldn't see them clearly from my chair in the living room, as they were hanging rather high up and were tiny because they were school photos. I want to study your faces. I want to concentrate on them at specific times, in quiet worship, like at a church service, and then have silent conversations with each of you. This is one of my favorite activities. I like, from time to time, to go to my bedroom after supper and take out my photo album and sit up in my bed with my comfortable pillows and a cup of coffee, and perhaps a Cuban lunch or a nutty club on my bedside table, and stare hard at the photos, at each one of you, very slowly turning the pages until I get to the end. I don't want to do that every day, just once a month or so. So that is something you need to know, that I took your photos off the wash line and put them in an album in my bedside table. The table with the good lamp on it, which is something you kids will have to hash out in terms of ownership, in terms of bequeathment, the good lamp. Another thing. Many years ago, I dug up Roland Sawatsky from his grave and reburied the urn holding his ashes out behind the grain shed on our farm. There's a small black stone there to mark the spot, but it has no words carved on it. It's the only black stone. There might still be a feed pail next to it, which I used to sit on. This is a lot to absorb, I think. But I know you are smart kids, and you are kind, and you are modern. I'll just say that I loved your grandpa Jake very much. He was a good man, and a good farmer, and a good Mennonite, and he was good to me. Even when they took his leg, he was good to me, and helped me, and never complained. You're probably wondering who Roland Sawatsky was. Roland was my neighbor on the farm next to ours, when we were kids, and then as teenagers, too. He was older than me by 3 years, and we never spoke. Very rarely did we speak. He sat at the back of the school bus with the older kids. Now, I wish I had known certain things then. For instance, one day he came over to our farm to tell my parents something, and he was on his horse. I went outside to look at his horse, and he gave me a carrot to feed it. I asked him what the horse's name was, and he said it was Trotsky. I wish I had known what the joke was so I could have laughed then and at other times. Of course, it's not a terribly funny joke, but I wish I had laughed more at things in life, especially at things presented as jokes. Roland was known in town as a very good pianist and very clever. He went to the university in Winnipeg, but still lived at home on the farm. My father told me that his parents hadn't wanted him to go to university, but that they'd reached a compromise with him staying on the farm and commuting to his classes in the city. His older sister had already left for Bible school in America. She wanted to work for Wycliffe Bible Translators in Quito, Ecuador, and I think that is what she did with the American fellow she met in Bible school. But I'm not sure. Her name is Ruthie. Once, along the property line between their farm and ours, in those trees there, when I was very young, 10 or 11, she told me that Roland was an idiot. Sometimes he went to concerts that people from the city performed in our high school auditorium. Just classical music, which was not considered a sin. Roland always sat in the very front row of chairs. People from town made fun of him behind his back, and to his face as well, for being so still and enrapt at these concerts, and for always sitting in the front row. One time, he himself gave a short concert there. It was very strange. He put up posters around town, and everybody was curious, but also worried about it, as in, why was he doing this? I still have one of those posters somewhere. You'll probably find it. One of you could keep it if you wanted to. Another thing you'd have to agree on amongst yourselves. There's a funny drawing on it that Roland made of himself at a piano and the date and time and place of the concert. I was there alone. I mean, I'd gone there alone. There were two or three other people. I sat in the front row. I remember Roland's hands gripping the sides of the piano bench. He had such hands, strong and steady. What would you call them today? Amazing? Everything is amazing today. He moved the bench around for a long time before he began to play, an inch forward, an inch back, an inch to the side, an inch to the other side. His hands gripped the bench that way until he found just the right place for it. I remember that just before he started, he moved his hands over his chest, from the top of his chest down, and then from the top again several times, as though he were smoothing his button-down shirt, as though he were keeping his heart in place. But now I think he was probably trying to wipe the sweat off his hands. One other thing I remember from the concert is that he leaned his head all the way back at times while he played. I had never seen that before, the head so far back with the throat exposed and his Adam's apple. I had only ever seen bowed heads. Heads praying or looking at crops or at little children or the floor or what have you. A few times during that concert, he put his head down, too, so far down that he was almost resting his face, his cheek on the piano keys, and playing at the same time. When he did that, I wanted to see him again with his head back. When his head was back, I saw sweat on his neck. I saw some of it slide down into his collar. His eyes were closed. And he made some sounds, too, that people teased him about and talked about in town for a long time afterward. That Roland Sawatsky, they'd say. And they'd imitate his sounds. After he finished playing, he stood up next to the piano. Nobody clapped, because we don't clap. I think he saw me there. He smiled. He was out of breath. I didn't talk to him at the concert. I went home. I put my head back as I walked home to see how that felt. It was dark. Then, a month later, or maybe it was longer, Roland came to the farm again to tell my parents that he was going away to study and wouldn't be able to help with the harvest that year. He was on his horse. He asked me if I wanted to ride with him, and I said no. He repeated that back to me. He said, "No?" or "Yes?" I said no again, and he put his head back and sort of groaned, the way he had when he was playing the piano in the school auditorium. But this time, he was just pretending to be devastated, I think. I touched his horse's face, and then he was gone. I never saw him again. So that was the last time we talked. My father told me that Roland had received a Rhodes Scholarship to Oxford University in England. A lot of people in town didn't understand why he would choose to leave. They didn't like to talk about it. They felt a bit sorry for Roland's parents. "What will he do with ideas?" they said. I remember Roland's father standing out under the yard light, with mosquitoes everywhere, talking with my father and shaking his head sadly, and my father putting his hand on Roland's father's shoulder. What happened then? Time passed, and I met Jake. Well, I'd known him all my life. And we got married and farmed and started our family. Sandra was born 9 months to the day from our wedding night. We stayed on the farm, my father's farm, and my parents moved into town. Then, one day, I was in the yard with the kids, and Roland's father came to talk to Jake. Roland's father seemed old to me then, but now I realize he wasn't that old. He and his wife still lived on the farm next to ours, and our fields were side by side. Jake wasn't at home when Roland's father came to talk to him, so he talked to me. He told me that Roland was in trouble in England. He didn't say what the trouble was. He said that he and his wife were going to travel to England to see Roland, and he asked if Jake and I could feed his animals while they were gone. Then, the next week, Roland's father came to our farm again, and this time Jake was at home, and they sat at the kitchen table. They prayed. It was September, but warm. Roland's parents were not going to go to England after all, Roland's father said. It would be too painful for Roland's mother. So instead, they were going to get Roland a plane ticket to come home. By then, he had been in England for several years, 8 or 9, I think. Later, after Roland's father left, I asked Jake when Roland was coming home. He thought the next week, but he wasn't sure. That night, I couldn't sleep, and the next day, I couldn't concentrate on my housework or even on the children. Dell got his foot caught in a trap of some sort that I had forgotten to put back in the bushes. I can't remember if it was a wolf trap or something else. How old is Dell now? 60? He still has that terrible scar from my neglect. The next week, on Wednesday evening after supper, Roland's father came to the house again. "Our Roland has died," he said. Like that. "Our Roland has died in England." Jake asked Roland's father how Roland had died. But his father didn't know. He stood and shook his head. He said that he and Roland's mother didn't want to know how Roland had died. It was 1969. In town, People said that Roland must have got caught up in a drug taking and whatnot and kept bad company. But that was just talk. His ashes would be sent back from England, and his parents would bury them in an urn on their farm. Our church doesn't believe in cremation, but the officials in England told Roland's father that shipping ashes would be a fraction of the cost. I remember that expression because Roland's father said it in English, although he only ever spoke Plautdeutsch, of shipping a body, and Roland's parents had very little money. Jake said that burning Roland would also prevent anyone from doing an autopsy on him and getting to the reason that he died, which was for the best, because nobody wanted to know why, especially not his mother. Roland could not be buried in the church graveyard because he had long ago stopped being a member of the church. Jake asked Roland's father if there would be a service. And Roland's father said there wouldn't be one. Jake asked if we could watch Roland be put into the ground and pay our respects then. Roland's father said, yes, we can do that. Which was how I came to know where on their land Roland was buried. So that's how it was then for a long time. On my daily walks, I'd pass Roland's grave and whisper yes. I meant to say yes. I couldn't just say this to myself in my head. I had to make a sound saying it. I mean, I had to say it, not just think it. If there were days when I was unable to walk past his grave, I'd say it twice or three times or whatever the number of days that I'd missed was. For instance, when the twins were born, I was hospitalized for 10 days and then had to say it 10 times. Eventually, people stopped talking about Roland and his mysterious death. The world was bad, they said, and Roland had found that out. Then, years and years later, Roland's parents both died within months of each other. They were old. Jake was gone by then, too. He was happy to die. He was in such pain. Our kids had all grown up and left home. Even Dell, with his mangled foot, had managed to leave. Roland's older sister, Ruthie, was living in Santa Barbara, California. She had met that American fellow at Bible school in Omaha, Nebraska, and they had married and moved to California after their mission work in Quito, Ecuador. When Roland's parents died, Ruthie flew home to take care of all the arrangements. They were allowed to be buried in the church cemetery because they were members. Ruthie came to the house and told me that she was selling her parents' farm and had hired a team to take Roland out of his grave and move him to Santa Barbara, California, to be with her and her kids and grandkids there. Her granddaughter, Madison, had had the idea that Roland should be with them and not alone in a frozen field somewhere in Canada. Ruthie said that her grandchildren hadn't known that Roland had existed until a cousin had told them about him at a funeral in Wheaton, Illinois. She shook her head. She didn't talk about Roland. She was angry that her cousin had blurted. I was struck by that word, how she said it, blurted. We had coffee and buns and cheese. Madison was studying conflict resolution. When Ruthie told me that, I laughed because I had never heard of such a thing. But Ruthie said that it was a serious field of study. She told me that these fellows would be coming for Roland in 2 days. I started digging that evening. I had a small flashlight. I was already in my 60s. I managed to dig quite far down that first night. I put a small baby blanket over the hole. I held it down with rocks in all four corners. And then I covered the blanket with twigs and grass and stalks of wheat. The next night, I went back and managed to dig all the way to Roland's urn, and I took him. I filled in the hole with the dirt I dug up and covered it again with twigs. That day, in the afternoon, the team arrived to move Roland. But of course they couldn't find him anywhere. They tried different places. Roland's sister came and said that that was very strange. She had been certain of the grave's location. The team worked all day and evening trying to find Roland. Eventually they left, and Ruthie went back to Santa Barbara, California, empty-handed. I buried Roland out behind the grain shed, as I mentioned. You will find the stone, I hope, and the pail I sat on, and then you'll know where Roland is. If you're reading this, it means that I'm gone too. The land is yours now, and I am wondering if you would let Roland's sister know where he is, so that she can bring him home and he can be together, finally, with his family, what's left of it, in California. Imagine Roland resting beneath palm trees, a warm sun all year. But if you can't do that, or if you don't want to do that, because I know you're all so busy, or if you don't know where his sister is, or how to get a hold of her, or if she's even alive, then you could, perhaps, leave Roland where he is. And just remember, as in hold it in your hearts, or even whisper it, if that doesn't feel too silly, that when I said no, I should in fact have said yes. You could say it out loud, lifting your eyes to heaven like a prayer. Dear God, please forgive Grandma. She meant to say yes. And now, from the fiction section of the May 25th, 2025 issue of The New Yorker, Fairy Pools by Patricia Lockwood. As soon as she touched down in Scotland, she believed in fairies. No, as soon as the rock and velvet of Inverness rushed up to her where she was falling, a long way through the Hagstone hole of a cloud, and she plunged down into the center of the cloud and stayed there. You used to set a child out for them, she thought, and was caught in the arms and awoke on the green hillside. Scotland, she heard her mother say in a voice weak from lack of iced tea. They were barely alive after 5 hours on the runway in Chicago and another 10 in the air. It's not the first real day, her husband kept reminding them. After a short stay in Inverness that night, they would go on to Skye tomorrow. He jangled a set of keys. In Ireland, 2 years before, it had transpired that her husband, a contrarian, was born to drive on the wrong side of the road, while her mother, a worse contrarian, whom she had defeated by marrying the former, planned to drag them all to hell that way. I'll drive, he told her mother now very loudly, and you sit on the passenger side and slam your foot to the floor whenever I get too close to the low stone wall. Deal, her mother agreed. She would also provide commentary and throw in those sharp little gaffes for free. As for her, she was silent and let herself be carried on and on toward the green hillside. The trees corresponded to an obsessive high school reading of The White Goddess. The sheep were spray-painted according to those who owned them. Actual lambs frisked in the fields on legs like little girls. Wait, she thought, am I confused about changelings? You put them out, did you get anything back? Or they were taken from you in the night and you woke up one morning? Her sister sat apart from her in the rental car. Her head was full of the child, her child, who'd been lost to them all just that January. From time to time, she saw her sister flicking through pictures on her phone with a chipped hot pink manicure, so quickly that the child appeared to be alive. It was as if her sister were smoothing a forehead, or touching away an eyelash, or wiping milk from a mouth, and once again the whole life was in motion. Wide load, she heard her mother saying to the asses of the sheep as if they were women. Upon arrival at the hotel, instead of taking pictures of the North Sea, she took pictures of elk bellowing on the walls and a little guy who appeared to be penetrating his bagpipes. This was her typical routine in other countries, to first take pictures of their pictures. It was a way of entering into the spirit, as was eating the complimentary hotcakes that had been left in your room, with its conscious and unconscious plaids, light, shadow, her hand crossed over her sister's, and that life called through the window, which called them out. She picked up a stone from the shore of the North Sea with a ring of mica around the top, flashing like the city on the water, and they piled into the car to go looking for it, wrapped in a series of preposterous scarves. When she thought of changelings, wasn't it mostly of the way they were wrapped, in rough gray cloth, with a triangle of face shining through? Between the time her mother had gone into her hotel room and the time she reappeared in the hall, her jeans had become wet. They would not dry for the rest of the trip. The wetness came to represent, in their minds, the iced tea she would never get. "Tea with ice?" she would ask hopefully, making a series of gestures to communicate the concept of iced tea, and would be brought a cup with 3 cubes in it by someone who looked almost medically concerned. "Tea with ice?" she asked at the Jamaican restaurant, holding up her hands like shocked daisies next to her eyes. They had gone to 3 or 4 places before finding one that was open. The chef, in a white hat, laughed and entered her mother's conspiracy. The night flowed like chest-struck oil outside the windows. She tried to fix the details of it in her mind. She never remembered the first night in another country. It was as if the change in altitude threw her off, or she had really touched down in another world. The restaurant, she would not remember later, was actually called Cool Runnings. Back at the hotel bar, the bartender told them the lamentable story of Irn Bru. It had once been sweeter, now it was less sweet. There were petitions and people hoarding it by the case in their flats. She ordered a can from him to make friends, for she saw no other way of doing it. Scottish bartenders had been given the opposite instructions to American ones. The taste, a pink electrocution of the tongue, was indescribable, and there was a version that was more so. She decided that if she were presented with a petition, she would sign it, and also support Scottish independence, if that was correct. Maybe, now that they were friends, she could ask the bartender, "But tea with ice?" her mother asked him, and the chance was gone. And so that was Loch Ness. She followed her sister through the ruins of the castle that overlooked it, taking pictures of her in empty rooms. Her gold hair whipped, her pink lipstick, drawn far beyond the outline of her mouth, smiled without her. People had really lived here. Could you still surprise someone's breathing near the ceiling, as you could upstairs in her sister's house? How long did that last? Her husband rubbed his hands. Finally, a country where the women were wearing enough cloth and where the wind persisted in exposing the tips of their ears. He had turned to pure itinerary. His mind was full of mileage, national parks, famed distilleries, tallest peaks. At this point, he believed he was Scottish. Everywhere they went, they saw bald heads that looked like his. "One of me," he would cry, pointing them out. A country full of thousands, and she had reached out and taken one. She fondled the mica stone. Maybe the soul was just that dearness nestled in the center of the body, like a chosen pebble in the palm of a hand. When you held someone, it was that dearness you felt, that chosenness. And he was dear. He would sniff the air and stop the car and say, "Macbeth lived here." He knew where there was Red Bull and where there might be ice, 3 cubes of it for her mother. In the car, they played a game of Would You Rather, except they misremembered it as I Would Never. This limited things somewhat. Her husband won easily. "I would never do that," he kept shouting, and then put down another point for himself. He had done all this to rinse her sister's mind of pain. Pain was one of the things he could not stand, along with Muppets and receipts, which were endocrine disruptors. "No, thank you," he said to the man at the gas station when he purchased 4 cans of the less sweet Irn Bru. Keep moving, he told them all in his long striding body, one foot in front of the other, or die. She did what she always did in a car, looked out the window, trusted, and let herself be carried along. The easiest life to imagine was the life of the postman. The easiest life to imagine was the life of the man who ran the ferry. The easiest life to imagine was that of a child in the castle that sat on the shore of Loch Ness, where the water was full, it was true, of little slipping necks. You could just grab on. They took turns reading aloud from Wikipedia about fighting hares, the symbology of thistles, which time of year the heather bloomed. The list of historical guys who actually believed in fairies was pretty long, she told them on the way to Glenbrittle. Her husband would have to update her entry to say that she had joined it. "Did you ever see a fairy's funeral, madame?" said Blake to a lady who happened to sit next to him. "Never, sir," said the lady. "I have," said Blake, "but not before last night." And he went on to tell how, in his garden, he had seen a procession of creatures of the size and color of green and gray grasshoppers, bearing a body laid out on a rose leaf, which they buried with songs and then disappeared. The fairy pools had been poured down. The walk up was like a slow exploration of the skeleton of an animal whose life was reenacted here and there by plunges of crystal water. There were natural bridges, caves heaped with uniform gray treasure, keyholes of bloodstone-colored water, raindrops on the lens, trees clinging to cliffs, the falls too fast for cameras, like fairies, and the long natural stairs that her sister climbed. People spoke every language. Europeans, who knew which laws to disregard, were stripping off their clothes and swimming. You could pose with a red bull next to the tallest waterfall and make it seem like you were peeing. A perfect place. They drank the water. Her husband sat on the edge of the deepest pool which touched the center of the earth and scooped it into a survivalist water filter he had bought on the internet. "This will let you drink water from anywhere, in any situation," he had told her intensely when it arrived in the mail. More and more of these situations were arising. As a child, she had watched Kevin Costner drink his own freshly distilled piss in Waterworld and just assumed it was something she would have to do as an adult, for the world would be different. They all drank a long swallow of the cool, clear water, which was somehow inflected with the word green. It went clear into the center of her, through the hagstone hole and the natural arch, plunging down the stairs of living rock. Inside her, Europeans stripped and splashed. "Now we are refreshed," he said. "Now we can go on." 20 pictures in her photo roll later, her sister's phone disappeared. Her black and white scarf and her rose gold phone, with the child's whole short life on it. It had been in the hospital with them, in her right hand, always. It had been what the next phone would not be, a warm eyewitness. Her sister was holding it in one picture, and then she wasn't, a bald mountain behind her, her face closed, impassible, there, and then gone. "I can't find it," she told her sister, desperate. She always had. $5 in a parking lot when that was real money. But there had been a switch. When she went up, the pools had looked one way, but when she came down again, searching for the rose gold phone, they looked another way. As if they were a story that needed to be told in order, from the beginning, without leaving anything out. Maybe this place was like the world. You could travel through it only once. She rolled her ankle on the rocks. An hour passed, and then another. "As soon as we get back in cell phone range," her husband kept telling them, "we can just call." But no one listened. Her sister's sear hair went among the grasses. Her head was full of the child. "We shouldn't have drunk the water," they would say later. It had angered the fairies. No, not angered. They had simply demanded something in exchange. But as soon as they saw what was on the phone, the face, the flicking motion, they'd know it was too much. They would give it back and keep only the scarf, which was just from Target. She fondled the mica stone. It stayed in her right hand always. She had picked up others along the way, on the shore of Loch Ness, while bouldering in Sligachan, and at the roadside stop where a horse had lifted up her sweater to nuzzle her belly as if he loved her. Maybe she was preparing to build a cairn, which in their miniature versions were everywhere. They snagged her eye, always. How did they stand? The balancing of the tallest cairns seemed to indicate that there were properties of physics we did not understand, or else they had been overruled by the Earth's desire to be surprising. The feeling that she was not quite herself began as they approached Glenfinnan. Her body went ahead of her into the church, rippling with bottle-brown light. Innsbruck, she thought. Sign the petition. Her eyes, floating a little in their sockets, went on looking. A vase with two daffodils. A statue begging for money. A historical plaque next to photos of water damage on the pillars, which at one point had to be replaced. Not an easy task, considering the size and weight of the stones and the height, the plaque yelled. We never want to see this again. Ha, ha, she heard herself saying, and placed a coin in the little plastic purse. The feeling intensified at the information center, where she found herself sliding down the wall with headphones on while listening to an interminable murder ballad. It came to her she was being murdered. The bridge overhead was bearing down on her. The church was falling toward her with its spire. Her skin in the bathroom mirror. We never want to see this again, she thought. Where have you been? Her husband asked when she emerged 20 minutes later. It was strange to know that when something was really wrong with her, no one would be able to tell. Faster, she told them in a monotone as her husband sped the car toward the castle. Something was going to happen. She didn't know what. After they checked in, she sat with the others for 10 minutes on the terrace, from which they could see the sun spilling like Chardonnay into the spread of the hills. The landscape appeared to her as one in which she was being hunted. Good night, she told them formally in the monotone, and went upstairs. Something was going to happen. A maid came to the door and asked her if she wanted something untranslatable. Her mouth, pale in a cameo face, formed the words several times. I cannot understand you, she finally said, weeping. Then, as she closed the door, it came to her. Turn down service. A little chocolate in the center of the pillow. The maid was Eastern European, and all at once she felt like four segments of an orange. The rotation of the world that had brought her here, and she stumbled out into the hall to say that it wasn't the accent, it was a problem with all language. Bathroom, she thought. I live in the bathroom, and she went to press her face against the rug. Why were the fairy pools so green, she wondered, and rose to her knees and ejected a long green waterfall into the trash can. Shall not mine true love stay with me when I am hurling, she thought, for she had suddenly remembered about the existence of Old English. What was under her legs now? What was carrying her to the bed? It was the old mistaken movement of the word moor. Arranging her head in the center of the pillow like a mint, she took a series of pictures as proof. She would show them all later, how close to death she had come, and leaned over like a cliff to release another waterfall. Arugula, she thought. I'm going to die alone in a Scottish castle because people have gotten too good for iceberg lettuce. Then remembered the Jamaican restaurant that the chef had kept open for them on that first night. bringing them mussels and baby clams and the firm cheeks of something that had no name. Could be, she thought, remembering how her husband always insisted she had a shellfish allergy, which she would not or could not accept. But she kept coming back to the coldest water in the world, which had gone down into the center of her, which belonged then and now to the fairies. Effing survivalist, she thought. Fancy cups, bug eating, no respect. They think they're preparing for any contingency, but they have no idea. They think regional camo will protect them. They think they're ready to leave the weak ones behind in the woods. They think there'll be no money. Her body was so heavy. The child was in all her limbs. She was carrying her through thickets and over green hills, laying her down nowhere, or else she would be taken. If she could feel her, as she had never before been able to feel anybody on this earth, it was because the child was the right size. Why had no one been the right size before? The door opened. A shape passed by her, neatly tied up her arugula, and made it disappear. Downstairs on the fairy tale terrace, over an exorbitant Scottish cheese board, her mother and husband and sister were all screaming at one another. Her mother had misread something about the Property Brothers on the internet and was insisting that they were being persecuted for being Christian. Their show had been canceled, she shouted, because of their embrace of the true faith. Her husband explained that they were Canadians, and Canadians didn't have faith. But she got redder and redder, believing that he was concealing reality from her. It was the Property Brothers, and they had lost it all. That was the sort of mistake people made now. It was hard to know how much to yell at her about it, because one day she would die. Also, she had taken care of the child. You had to think of her hands cupping the large head, and how one day the child had let her head fall forward. It seemed purposefully, so that her open mouth landed smack against her grandmother's cheek. They decided to call that a kiss, for narrative purposes. They had made many such decisions in those days. Gossip was the life of a castle. And by the next morning, everyone knew. Are you all right? A series of pale, cameo-faced women asking her, bending tenderly over her at breakfast. Any one of them could have been the woman at the door, trying to give her the mint that she could not receive. Her mother, too, looked a little green around the edges. The brothers, meekly, were not mentioned. She thought of the phrase, throwing up your toenails. She thought of her mother counting hers, though it had been her husband who came in the end, hadn't it? Tiptoeing out of the castle at midnight with a bag of homemade pesto in one hand. They stopped at a store where the owner had decorated his display cases with blocks of movable type, and her sister asked if he would sell her four letters of it, but he wouldn't. That was what was smallest in the world, she thought. Not atoms, but movable type, and you could not buy four letters of it for any price. Thank you anyway, her sister said politely. My daughter, she said, turning away and walking past the case again, where by some chance the atoms actually spelled out the child's name. Let's turn here, her husband said, thoughtfully, as they passed a sign that said, Rob Roy. What about him? They all wondered. Hadn't he been the guy in that film, played by Liam Neeson, before he made a whole career of his children being taken, with the big blouse, and maybe he shouted, freedom? It was his grave. Everyone who had been there before them seemed to know, and had left coins and scraps of tartan and white daffodils for him. The headstone read, McGregor despite them, which was even more confusing. The daffodils, her husband reported, might have been because of Wordsworth, who had written a long poem about coming here once. Forgive me if the phrase be strong, a poet worthy of Rob Roy must scorn a timid song. Whatever that means, he said, looking at his phone. The movie poster was two people breathing into each other's mouth. Flashing sword fights, land disputes, and nighttime raids, and what looked to be a long male ponytail. One of the most famous figures in Scottish history. "Wait, really?" they asked one another. The hand of anonymity closed around them, squeezed. Was it possible that only a name could be passed down? Her mother stalked the perimeter of the grave, faced with a philosophical question. How to take pictures of the ass of a ghost. "We should commemorate him," her sister said solemnly. A bridge stretched between the place where the body was buried and where it was not, and she and her sister walked over it arm in arm. They peed in the woods behind the church, thereby linking themselves bodily with Rob Roy forever. They would remember him now, whoever he was, whatever he had done. And, far and near, through vale and hill, are faces that attest the same. The proud heart flashing through the eyes at sound of Rob Roy's name. A year later, she would find herself obsessively revising 150 words she had written about this experience. The grave, the daffodils, the peeing in the glen, the church that was just a door in the air. But she could not make it mean anything, and she did not know why. "He was a property brother," she said in the end, and put one of her stones on the name on the grave. On Isle Marie, local tradition held that insanity could be cured by towing someone around the island behind a boat. Oh, good, she thought, easy. But local tradition also held that nothing must ever be taken from the island, be it even a pebble from the shore, lest the insanity formerly cured there return to the outside world. Oh no, she thought, hard. Isle Marie was famous for the wish tree, an oak that had been hammered so full of pennies that it had died of copper poisoning. Many things still stood that way, hammered full of wishes. A certain percentage of the people now visiting Scotland appeared to be sex tourists. Her husband was one of them, and he insisted that they stop at the Clavacairns to see the standing stones. "It's not a full ring," he told them with resignation, "but we'll take what we can get." The stones were supposed to carry you back in time, and she had hardly laid a hand on the tallest one before she felt herself back in time, casting a shadow to say 3 o'clock. Cows stood fogged on the opposite hillside, still belonging to the Bronze Age. The sky touched the tops of their heads, like the corner of the ceiling in her sister's house, where the breathing still went on. It was the last real day. It was the cairn she walked into, with its heart dug out. It was the party of Victorians she stared at for a long time on the informational plaque. They were happy. They had done a good day's work with pickaxes and cucumber sandwiches. The sun had consented to fall for a time through the particular patterns of their lace. It was terrible to be a tourist, she thought, but after death you didn't feel like a tourist anymore. You were a current of the air. You went everywhere, into people's mouths and out. "Oh, my God, I think I found it," she said, going through her photos. She'd been sure that it had happened between pictures, but when she went back, she could pinpoint the moment her sister had set the scarf and the phone down. Her dark and wind-whipped figure turned away, facing into the distance toward the foot of the Black Cuilan Mountains. Giants heaved above her, and she was small. And there it was, a loose little heap of pattern behind her and the glint of the rose-gold phone. "I can't believe we got it back," her sister said softly, spreading two fingers apart to zoom in. When they finally made it into range and called the number, she had to be the one to call. Her husband was driving. Her sister couldn't speak, and her mother's jeans were wet. Someone actually answered, as her husband all along had promised would happen. "I have it," the woman said. "It's safe." She was driving it to the police station in Portree at that moment, the child on her lap with a triangle of face showing. "I love you," she said simply to the woman on the phone, who understood her perfectly. "An American would never," her husband said, happy. He had scored another point in the game. But her breath would not stay inside her, as if it were pushing the wind. "I begged them to give it back, and they did." "There is an exchange," she thought. "Something passes between this life and the next that allows you to be here for a while. The fairy pools don't look the same on the way down as on the way up, and you walk through this world only once." She had drunk the coldest water in the world and thrown it up again green. No one could say she hadn't really been here. In her head, she signed the petition for Scottish independence. In her head, she signed the petition for Erin Drew to be sweet again. In her head, she stacked a cairn. In her head, she lifted the hard heart out of a grave. The last thing she would do before she left Scotland was to stumble out of her hotel in a straight line like a sleepwalker and set the stone with the ring of mica in the knot hole of a tree. Not understanding why she was doing it, crying when she realized it was gone, she walked through the world. The exchange rate stood. Everyone must pay. And as usual, I'll end with some poetry. First, from the August 4th, 2025 issue, Bob Marley Live, 1980, by Kwame Dawes. In Kingston after the storm, the yard cools, the grass slippery underfoot, leaves dripping, the air heavy with fatigue. I move to the low branch of the coulee plum tree, straddle it, and wait for the wind to clear the growing anticipation of gloom. And there he is, sculpted pale wood, gleaming with cold sweat, stern prophecy in each inflection, the dark root tendrils, mangrove growing out and into soil. You know now what death looks like, the economy of movement, the soul giving as if straining against some terror lurking, the voice turning his syntax into a final plea. I remember, I remember, I remember when. They could not have known, they who rolled under the incense of his sound, could not have known that even he did not truly know every strained word, a holy benediction. Tonight I watch again and again the garish light, the stoic faces of the three women, their voices his buoy, his craft across the unsteady waters. Even they did not know themselves to be women at the tomb, or later ancestresses in the open field, looking back. And in this we understand the impossibility of grace, the squalor, the decay, the bodies rot, and still the light, the light. I say here that it is not music, not so ordinary. It is a sacrament. It remains a sacrament. And this is all that must be said. Next, from the July 15, 2025 issue of The New Yorker, Onions, by Peter Balakian. When my tears dry, I can see your rings spilling off the cutting board and the white juice runnel up my fingers. Afterlife of your swelling bulb under the tapered lips in the earth. Egyptians saw eternity in your unspooling center. Ramses covered his eyes with your concentric rings. The Romans grew you in gardens of volcanic ash, rubbing you on sores, dog bites, lumbago. Armenians boiled your parchment skin to make yellow umber for silk and wool. Your calyx and leaf unwind a core of air inside air and staring down there now, I'm seeing it all well up through the blurry light. Sometimes I cut you quickly for fry up with sweet peppers, or saute slow in vermouth for marsala or mince for salsa. My grandfather sliced you raw for the long refugee road. Gran melded you into near nothing for the sweet hereafter of lamb shank. Ubiquitous as I open the front door, as the cold dark comes early and your vapor covers the glass. And now, from the July 28th, 2025 issue, Astounding Stories by Robert Pinsky. Fear of the foreign and the fear of being foreign. Terror of nuns from the star of the sea, Lyceum, afloat in hooded habits with punishing rulers. Difference. Wanting someone who looks like me is different in different spaces. Jews and Der Stürmer don't look like Paul Newman or Lauren Bacall. The nuns would teach you a lesson, said my mother. After her injury, she and I spoke little, concussed as she was, apart in the dim room. But we did share the sci-fi magazines. We earthlings colonized, or colonial history remade as future. One story made me wonder, was I really one of the doomed ancestors stranded to die on a foreign planet, or was I the microscopic descendants they designed? We've run out of time for today's episode of The New Yorker Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and you'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and/or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That website again is ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. We'd love to hear from you. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.